It might say that $5 million a year would be the kind of figure that should satisfy Henderson's interest in receiving the salary he feels he is worth. Something on the order of a 5-year contract should meet his need for job security. Having thought about your interests, you should go into a meeting not only with one or more specific options that would meet your legitimate interests, but also with an open mind. An open mind is not an empty one. Be hard on the problem, soft on the people. You could be just as hard in talking about your interests as any negotiator can be in talking about their position. In fact, it is usually advisable to be hard. It may not be wise to commit yourself to your position, but it is wise to commit yourself to your interests. This is the place in a negotiation to spend your aggressive energies. The other side, being concerned with their own interests, will tend to have overly optimistic expectations of the range of possible agreements. Often the wisest solutions, those that produce the maximum gain for you, at the minimum cost to the other side, are produced only by strongly advocating your interests. Two negotiators, each pushing hard for their interests, will often stimulate each other's creativity in thinking up mutually advantageous solutions. The construction company, concerned with inflation, may place a high value on its interest in keeping costs down and in getting the job done on time. You may have to shake them up. Some honest emotion may help restore a better balance between profits and children's lives. Do not let your desire to be conciliatory stop you from doing justice to your problem. Surely you're not saying that my son's life is worth less than the price of a fence. You wouldn't say that about your son. I don't believe you're an insensitive person, Mr. Jenkins. Let's figure out how to solve this problem. If they feel personally threatened by an attack on the problem, they may grow defensive and may cease to listen. This is why it is important to separate the people from the problem. Attack the problem without blaming the people. Go even further and be personally supportive. Listen to them with respect. Show them courtesy. Express your appreciation for their time and effort. Emphasize your concern with meeting their basic needs and so on. Show them that you are attacking the problem, not them. One useful rule of thumb is to give positive support to the human beings on the other side, equal in strength to the vigor with which you emphasize the problem. This combination of support and attack may seem inconsistent. Psychologically, it is. The inconsistency helps make it work. A well-known theory of psychology, the theory of cognitive dissonance, holds that people dislike inconsistency and will act to eliminate it. By attacking a problem, such as speeding trucks on a neighborhood street, and at the same time giving the company representative, Mr. Jenkins, positive support, you create cognitive dissonance for him. To overcome this dissonance, he will be tempted to disassociate himself from the problem in order to join you in doing something about it. Fighting hard on the substantive issues increases the pressure for an effective solution. Giving support to the human beings on the other side tends to improve your relationship and to increase the likelihood of reaching agreement. It is the combination of support and attack that works. Either alone is likely to be insufficient. Negotiating hard for your interests does not mean being closed to the other side's point of view. Quite the contrary. You can hardly expect the other side to listen to your interests and discuss the options you suggest if you don't take their interests into account and show yourself to be open to their suggestions. Successful negotiation requires being both firm and open. Chapter 4. Invent options for mutual gain. The case of Israel and Egypt, negotiating over who should keep how much of the Sinai Peninsula, illustrates both a major problem in negotiation and a key opportunity. The problem is a common one. There seems to be no way to split the pie that leaves both parties satisfied. Often, you are negotiating along a single dimension, such as the amount of territory, the price of a car, the length of a lease on an apartment, or the size of a commission on a sale. At other times, you face what appears to be an either-or choice that is either markedly favorable to you or to the other side. In a divorce settlement, who gets the house? Who gets custody of the children? You may see the choice as one between winning and losing, and neither side will agree to lose. Even if you do win and get the car for $15,000, the lease for 5 years, or the house and kids, you have a sinking feeling that they will not let you forget it. Whatever the situation, your choices seem limited. The Sinai example also makes clear the opportunity. A creative option like a demilitarized Sinai can often make the difference between deadlock and agreement. One lawyer we know attributes his success directly to his ability to invent solutions advantageous to both his client and the other side. He expands the pie before dividing it. Skill at inventing options is one of the most useful assets a negotiator can have. Yet all too often, negotiators end up like the proverbial children who quarreled over an orange. After they finally agreed to divide the orange in half, the first child took one half, ate the fruit, and threw away the peel, while the other threw away the fruit and used the peel from the second half in baking a cake. All too often, negotiators leave money on the table. They fail to reach agreement when they might have, or the agreement they do reach could have been better for each side. Too many negotiations end up with half an orange for each side, instead of the whole fruit for one and the whole peel for the other. Why? Diagnosis. As valuable as it is to have many options, people involved in a negotiation rarely sense a need for them. In a dispute, people usually believe that they know the right answer. Their view should prevail. In a contract negotiation, they are equally likely to believe that their offer is reasonable and should be adopted, perhaps with some adjustment in the price. All available answers appear to lie along a straight line between their position and yours. Often the only creative thinking shown is to suggest splitting the difference. In most negotiations, there are four major obstacles that inhibit the inventing of an abundance of options. 1. Premature judgment. 2. Searching for the single answer. 3. The assumption of a fixed pie. And 4. Thinking that solving their problem is their problem. To overcome these constraints, you need to understand them. Premature judgment. Inventing options does not come naturally. Not inventing is the normal state of affairs, even when you are outside a stressful negotiation. If you are asked to name the one person in the world most deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize, any answer you might start to propose would immediately encounter your reservations and doubts. How could you be sure that that person was the most deserving? Your mind might well go blank, or you might throw out a few answers that would reflect conventional thinking. Well, maybe the Pope or the President? Nothing is so harmful to inventing as a critical sense waiting to pounce on the drawbacks of any new idea. Judgment hinders imagination. Under the pressure of a forthcoming negotiation, your critical sense is likely to be sharper. Practical negotiation appears to call for practical thinking, not wild ideas. Your creativity may be even more stifled by the presence of those on the other side. Suppose you are negotiating with your boss over your salary for the coming year. You have asked for a $4,000 raise. Your boss has offered you $1,500, a figure that you have indicated is unsatisfactory. In a tense situation like this, you are not likely to start inventing imaginative solutions. You may fear that if you suggest some bright half-baked idea, like taking half the increase in a raise and half in additional benefits, you might look foolish. Your boss might say, "Be serious. You know better than that. It would upset company policy. I am surprised that you even suggested it." If on the spur of the moment you invent a possible option of spreading out the raise over time, your boss may take it as an offer. "I'm prepared to start negotiating on that basis." Since whatever you say may be taken as a commitment, you will think twice before saying anything. You may also fear that by inventing options, you will disclose some piece of information that will jeopardize your bargaining position. If you should suggest, for example, that the company help finance the house you are about to buy, your boss may conclude that you intend to stay and that you will in the end accept any raise in salary the boss decides to offer. Searching for the single answer. In most people's minds, inventing simply is not part of the negotiating process. People see their job as narrowing the gap between positions, not broadening the options available. They tend to think, "We're having a hard enough time agreeing as it is. The last thing we need is a bunch of different ideas." Since the end product of negotiation is a single decision, they fear that free-floating discussion will only delay and confuse the process. If the first impediment to creative thinking is premature criticism, the second is premature closure. By looking from the outset for the single best answer, you are likely to short-circuit a wiser decision-making process in which you select from a large number of possible answers. the assumption of a fixed pie. A third explanation for why there may be so few good options on the table is that each side sees the situation as essentially either or. Either I get what is in dispute or you do. A negotiation often appears to be a fixed-sum game. $100 more for you on the price of a car means $100 less for me. Why bother to invent if all the options are obvious and I can satisfy you only at my own expense? Thinking that solving their problem is their problem. A final obstacle to inventing realistic options lies in each side's concern with only its own immediate interests. For you, as a negotiator, to reach an agreement that meets your own self-interest, you need to develop a solution that also appeals to the self-interest of the other. Yet, emotional involvement on one side of an issue makes it difficult to achieve the detachment necessary to think up wise ways of meeting the interests of both sides. We've got enough problems of our own. They can look after theirs. There also frequently exists a psychological reluctance to accord any legitimacy to the views of the other side. It seems disloyal to think up ways to satisfy them. Short-sighted self-concern thus leads a negotiator to develop only partisan positions, partisan arguments, and one-sided solutions. Prescription. To invent creative options, then, you will need to, 1, separate the act of inventing options from the act of judging them, 2, broaden the options on the table rather than look for a single answer, 3, search for mutual gains, and 4, invent ways of making their decisions easy. Separate inventing from deciding. Since judgment hinders imagination, separate the creative act from the critical one. Separate the process of thinking up possible decisions from the process of selecting among them. Invent first, decide later. As a negotiator, you will of necessity do much inventing by yourself. It's not easy. By definition, inventing new ideas requires you to think about things that are not already in your mind. You should therefore consider the desirability of arranging an inventing or brainstorming session with a few colleagues or friends. Such a session can effectively separate inventing from deciding. A brainstorming session is designed to produce as many ideas as possible to solve the problem at hand. The key ground rule is to postpone all criticism and evaluation of ideas. The group simply invents ideas without pausing to consider whether they are good or bad, realistic or unrealistic. With those inhibitions removed, one idea should stimulate another, like firecrackers setting off one another. In a brainstorming session, people need not fear looking foolish since wild ideas are explicitly encouraged. And in the absence of the other side, negotiators need not worry about disclosing confidential information or having a half-baked idea taken as a serious commitment. There is no right way to run a brainstorming session. Rather, you should tailor it to your needs and resources. In doing so, you may find it useful to consider the following guidelines. Before brainstorming, 1. Define your purpose. Think of what you would like to walk out of the meeting with. 2. Choose a few participants. The group should normally be large enough to provide a stimulating interchange, yet small enough to encourage both individual participation and freewheeling inventing, usually between 5 and 8 people. 3. Change the environment. Select a time and place, distinguishing the session as much as possible from regular discussions. The more different a brainstorming session seems from a normal meeting, the easier it is for participants to suspend judgment. 4. Design an informal atmosphere. What does it take for you and others to relax? It may be talking over a drink, or meeting at a vacation lodge in some picturesque spot, or dressing less formally during the meeting and calling one another by your first names. 5. Choose a facilitator. Someone at the meeting needs to facilitate, to keep the meeting on track, to make sure everyone gets a chance to speak, to enforce any ground rules, and to stimulate discussion by asking questions. During brainstorming, 1. Seat the participants side by side facing the problem. The physical reinforces the psychological. Physically sitting side by side can reinforce the mental attitude of tackling a common problem together. People facing each other tend to respond personally and engage in dialogue or argument. People sitting side by side in a semicircle of chairs facing a flip chart or whiteboard tend to respond to the problem depicted there. 2. clarify the ground rules, including the no criticism rule. If the participants do not all know each other, the meeting begins with introductions all around, followed by clarification of the ground rules. Outlaw negative criticism of any kind. Joint inventing produces new ideas because each of us invents only within the limits set by our working assumptions. If ideas are shot down unless they appeal to all participants, the implicit goal becomes to advance an idea that no one will shoot down. If, on the other hand, wild ideas are encouraged, even those that in fact lie well outside the realm of the possible, the group may generate from these ideas other options that are possible and that no one would previously have considered. Other ground rules you may want to adopt are to make the entire session off the record and to refrain from attributing ideas to any participant. 3. Brainstorm. Once the purpose of the meeting is clear, let your imaginations go. Try to come up with a long list of ideas, approaching the question from every conceivable angle. 4. Record the ideas in full view. Recording ideas either on a whiteboard or flip charts gives the group a tangible sense of collective achievement. It reinforces the no criticism rule, it reduces the tendency to repeat, and it helps stimulate other ideas. After brainstorming, 1. Star the most promising ideas. After brainstorming, relax the no criticism rule to begin winnowing out the most promising ideas. You are still not at the stage of deciding. You're merely nominating ideas worth developing further. Mark those ideas that members of the group think are best. 2. Invent improvements for promising ideas. Take one promising idea and invent ways to make it better and more realistic, as well as ways to carry it out. The task at this stage is to make the idea as attractive as you can. Preface constructive criticism with, "What I like best about that idea is... might it be even better if..." 3. Set up a time to evaluate ideas and decide. Before you break, draw up a selective and improved list of ideas from the session and set up a time for deciding which of these ideas to advance in your negotiation and how. Consider brainstorming with the other side. Although more difficult than brainstorming with your own side, brainstorming with people from the other side can also prove extremely valuable. It is more difficult because of the increased risk that you will say something that prejudices your interests, despite the rules established for a brainstorming session. You may disclose confidential information inadvertently or lead the other side to mistake an option you devise for an offer. Nevertheless, joint brainstorming sessions have the great advantages of producing ideas that take into account the interests of all those involved, of creating a climate of joint problem-solving, and of educating each side about the concerns of the other. To protect yourself when brainstorming with the other side, distinguish the brainstorming session explicitly from a negotiating session where people state official views and speak on the record. People are so accustomed to meeting for the purpose of reaching agreement that any other purpose needs to be clearly stated. To reduce the risk of appearing committed to any given idea, you can make a habit of advancing at least two alternatives at the same time. You can also put on the table options with which you obviously disagree. "I could give you the house for nothing, or you could pay me $1 million in cash for it, or..." Since you are plainly not proposing either of these ideas, the ones that follow are labeled as mere possibilities, not proposals. To get the flavor of a joint brainstorming session, let us suppose the leaders of a local union are meeting with the management of a coal mine to brainstorm on ways to reduce unauthorized 1 or 2 day strikes. 10 people, 5 from each side, are present, sitting around a table facing a whiteboard. A neutral facilitator asks the participants for their ideas and writes them up on the whiteboard. Facilitator: "Okay, now let's see what ideas you have for dealing with this problem of unauthorized work stoppages. Let's try to get 10 ideas on the whiteboard in 5 minutes, okay? Let's start. Tom?"
Tom, union:
"A foreman ought to be able to settle a union member's grievance on the spot."
Facilitator:
"Good, I've got it down. Jim, you've got your hand up?"
Jim, management:
"A union member ought to talk to his foreman about a problem before taking any action that..."
Tom, union:
"They do, but the foreman don't listen."
Facilitator:
"Tom, please, no criticizing yet. We agreed to postpone that until later, okay?
How about you, Jerry? You look like you've got an idea."
Jerry, union:
When a strike issue comes up, the union members should be allowed to meet in the bathhouse immediately.
Roger, management.
Management could agree to let the bathhouse be used for union meetings and could assure the employees' privacy by shutting the doors and keeping the foreman out.
Carol, management.
How about adopting the rule that there will be no strike without giving the union leaders and management a chance to work it out on the spot?
Jerry, union.
How about speeding up the grievance procedure and having a meeting within 24 hours if the foreman and union member don't settle it between themselves?
Karen, union.
Yeah, and how about organizing some joint training for the union members and the foreman on how to handle their problems together?
Phil, union.
If a person does a good job, let them know it.
John, management.
Establish friendly relations between union people and management people.
Facilitator.
That sounds promising, John, but could you be more specific?
John, management.
Well, how about organizing a union management softball team?
Tom, union. And a bowling team, too.
Roger, management.
How about an annual picnic get-together for all the families?
And on it goes as the participants brainstorm lots of ideas. Many of the ideas might never have come up except in such a brainstorming session, and some of them may prove effective in reducing unauthorized strikes. Time spent brainstorming together is surely among the best spent time in negotiation. But whether you brainstorm together or not, separating the act of developing options from the act of deciding on them is extremely useful in any negotiation. Discussing options differs radically from taking positions. Whereas one side's position will conflict with another's, options invite other options. The very language you use differs. It consists of questions, not assertions. It is open, not closed. One option is, what other options have you thought of? What if we agreed to this? How about doing it this way? How would this work? What would be wrong with that? Invent before you decide.
Broaden your options. Even with the best of intentions, participants in a brainstorming session are likely to operate on the assumption that they are really looking for the one best answer, trying to find a needle in a haystack by picking up every blade of hay. At this stage in a negotiation, however, you should not be looking for the right path. You are developing room within which to negotiate. Room can be made only by having a substantial number of markedly different ideas, ideas on which you and the other side can build later in the negotiation, and among which you can then jointly choose. A vintner making a fine wine chooses his grapes from a number of varieties. A sports team looking for star players will send talent scouts to scour the local leagues and college teams all over the nation. The same principle applies to negotiation. The key to wise decision-making, whether in winemaking, sports, or negotiation, lies in selecting from a great number and variety of options. If you were asked who should receive the Nobel Peace Prize this year, you would do well to answer, well, let's think about it, and then generate a list of about 100 names from diplomacy, business, journalism, religion, law, agriculture, politics, academia, medicine, and other fields, making sure to dream up a lot of wild ideas. You would almost certainly end up with a better decision this way than if you tried to decide right from the start. A brainstorming session frees people to think creatively. Once freed, they need ways to think about their problems and to generate constructive solutions. Multiply options by shuttling between the specific and the general, the circle chart. The task of inventing options involves four types of thinking. One is thinking about a particular problem, the factual situation you dislike, for example, a smelly, polluted river that runs by your land. The second type of thinking is descriptive analysis. You diagnose an existing situation in general terms. You sort problems into categories and tentatively suggest causes. The river water may have a high content of various chemicals or too little oxygen. You may suspect various upstream industrial plants. The third type of thinking, again in general terms, is to consider what ought, perhaps, to be done. Given the diagnoses you have made, you look for prescriptions that theory may suggest, such as reducing chemical effluent, reducing diversions of water, or bringing fresh water from some other river. The fourth and final type of thinking is to come up with some specific and feasible suggestions for action. Who might do what tomorrow to put one of these general approaches into practice? For instance, the state environmental agency might order an upstream industry to limit the quantity of chemical discharge. Imagine these steps as a circle chart.
with each step in one of four quadrants of a circle. In the bottom left quadrant, we identify the problem. In the top left, we analyze the problem. In the top right quadrant, we generate possible approaches to the problem, and in the bottom right quadrant, we come up with action ideas. Laying out these four types of thinking in such a way suggests them as steps to be taken in sequence. If all goes well, the specific action invented in this way will, if adopted, deal with your original problem. The circle chart provides an easy way of using one good idea to generate others. With one useful action idea before you, you, or a group of you who are brainstorming, can go back and try to identify the general approach of which the action idea is merely one application. You can then think up other action ideas that would apply the same general approach to the real world. Similarly, you can go back one step further and ask, if this theoretical approach appears useful, what is the diagnosis behind it? Having articulated a diagnosis, you can generate other approaches for dealing with a problem analyzed in that way, and then look for actions putting these new approaches into practice. One good option on the table thus opens the door to asking about the theory that makes this option good, and then using that theory to invent more options. An example may illustrate the process. In thinking about how to deal with the conflict in Northern Ireland, one idea generated in the 1980s was to have Catholic and Protestant teachers prepare a common workbook on the history of Northern Ireland for use in the primary grades of both school systems. The book, which was actually created and used in the 1990s, presents Northern Irish history as seen from different points of view and gives the children exercises that involve role-playing and putting themselves in other people's shoes. More useful ideas were then generated by starting with this specific action suggestion and asking what theoretical approaches underlay it. This resulted in such general propositions as, there should be some common educational content in the two school systems. Catholics and Protestants should work together on small, manageable projects. Understanding should be promoted in young children before it is too late. History should be taught in ways that illuminate partisan perceptions. Working from these theories, additional action suggestions were invented, including a joint Catholic and Protestant film project that presents the history of Northern Ireland as seen through different eyes, a teacher exchange program, and having some common classes for primary-age children in the two systems. Look through the eyes of different experts. Another way to generate multiple options is to examine your problem from the perspective of different professions and disciplines. In thinking up possible solutions to a dispute over custody of a child, for example, look at the problem as it might be seen by an educator, a banker, a psychiatrist, a civil rights lawyer, a minister, a nutritionist, a doctor, a feminist, a football coach, or one with some other special point of view. If you are negotiating a business contract, invent options that might occur to a banker, an inventor, a labor leader, a speculator in real estate, a stockbroker, an economist, a tax expert, or a socialist. You can also combine the use of the circle chart with this idea of looking at a problem through the eyes of different experts. Consider in turn how each expert would diagnose the situation, what kinds of approaches each might suggest, and what practical suggestions would follow from those approaches. Invent agreements of different strengths. You can multiply the number of possible agreements on the table by thinking of weaker versions you might want to have on hand in case a sought-for agreement proves beyond reach. If you cannot agree on substance, perhaps you can agree on procedure. If a shoe factory cannot agree with a wholesaler on who should pay for a shipment of damaged shoes, perhaps they can agree to submit the issue to an arbitrator. Similarly, where a permanent agreement is not possible, perhaps a provisional agreement is. At the very least, if you and the other side cannot reach first-order agreement, you can usually reach second-order agreement. That is, agree on where you disagree so that you both know the issues in dispute, which are not always obvious. The following pairs of adjectives suggest potential agreements of differing strengths. Stronger, substantive. Weaker, procedural. Stronger, permanent. Weaker, provisional. Stronger, comprehensive. Weaker, partial. Stronger, final. Weaker, in principle. Stronger, unconditional. Weaker, contingent. Stronger, binding. Weaker, non-binding. Stronger, first order. Weaker, second order.
change the scope of a proposed agreement. Consider the possibility of varying not only the strength of the agreement, but also its scope. You could, for instance, fractionate your problem into smaller and perhaps more manageable units. To a prospective editor for your book, you might suggest, "How about editing the first chapter for $300 and we'll see how it goes?" Agreements may be partial, involve fewer parties, cover only selected subject matters, apply only to a certain geographical area, or remain in effect for only a limited period of time. It is also provocative to ask how the subject matter might be enlarged so as to sweeten the pot and make agreement more attractive. The dispute between India and Pakistan over the waters of the Indus River became more amenable to settlement when the World Bank entered the discussions. The parties were challenged to invent new irrigation projects, new storage dams, and other engineering works for the benefit of both nations, all to be funded with the assistance of the bank. Look for mutual gain. The third major block to creative problem solving lies in the assumption of a fixed pie. The less for you, the more for me. Rarely, if ever, is this assumption true. First of all, both sides can always be worse off than they are now. Chess looks like a zero-sum game. If one loses, the other wins, until a dog trots by and knocks over the table, spills the beer, and leaves you both worse off than before. Even apart from a shared interest in averting joint loss, there almost always exists the possibility of joint gain. This may take the form of developing a mutually advantageous relationship or of satisfying the interests of each side with a creative solution. Identify shared interests. In theory, it is obvious that shared interests help produce agreement. By definition, inventing an idea that meets shared interests is good for you and good for them. In practice, however, the picture seems less clear. In the middle of a negotiation over price, shared interests may not appear obvious or relevant. How then can looking for shared interests help? Let's take an example. Suppose you are the manager of an oil refinery. Call it Townsend Oil. The mayor of Pageville, the city where the refinery is located, has told you he wants to raise the taxes Townsend Oil pays to Pageville from $2 million a year to $4 million. You have told him that you think $2 million a year is quite sufficient. The negotiation stands there. He wants more. You want to pay what you have been paying. In this negotiation, a typical one in many ways, where do shared interests come into play? Let's take a closer look at what the mayor wants. He wants money. Money undoubtedly to pay for city services, a new civic center, perhaps, and to relieve the ordinary taxpayers. But the city cannot obtain all the money it needs for now and for the future just from Townsend Oil. They will look for money from the petrochemical plant across the street, for example, and for the future from new businesses and from the expansion of existing businesses. The mayor, a businessman himself, would also like to encourage industrial expansion and attract new businesses that will provide new jobs and strengthen Pageville's economy. What are your company's interests? Given the rapid changes in the technology of refining oil and the antiquated condition of your refinery, you are presently considering a major refurbishment and expansion of the plant. You are concerned that the city may later increase its assessment of the value of the expanded refinery, thus making taxes even higher. Consider also that you have been encouraging a plastics plant to locate itself nearby to make convenient use of your product. Naturally, you worry that the plastics plant will have second thoughts once they see the city increasing taxes. The shared interests between the mayor and you now become more apparent. You both agree on the goals of fostering industrial expansion and encouraging new industries. If you did some inventing to meet these shared goals, you might come up with several ideas. A tax holiday of 7 years for new industries. A joint publicity campaign with the Chamber of Commerce to attract new companies. A reduction in taxes for existing industries that choose to expand. Such ideas might save you money while still filling the city's coffers. If, on the other hand, the negotiation soured the relationship between company and town, both would lose. You might cut back on your corporate contributions to the city charities and school athletics. The city might become unreasonably tough in enforcing the building code and other ordinances. Your personal relationship with the city's political and business leaders might grow unpleasant. The relationship between the sides, often taken for granted and overlooked, frequently outweighs in importance the outcome of any particular issue.
As a negotiator, you will almost always want to look for solutions that will leave the other side satisfied as well. If the customer feels cheated in a purchase, the store owner has also failed. He may lose a customer and his reputation may suffer. An outcome in which the other side gets absolutely nothing is worse for you than one that leaves them mollified. In almost every case, your satisfaction depends, to a degree, on making the other side sufficiently content with an agreement to want to live up to it. 3 points about shared interests are worth remembering. First, shared interests lie latent in every negotiation. They may not be immediately obvious. Ask yourself, do we have a shared interest in preserving our relationship? What opportunities lie ahead for cooperation and mutual benefit? What costs would we bear if negotiations broke off? Are there common principles, like a fair price, that we both can respect? Second, shared interests are opportunities, not godsends. To be of use, you need to make something out of them. It helps to make a shared interest explicit and to formulate it as a shared goal. In other words, make it concrete and future-oriented. As manager of Townsend Oil, for example, you could set a joint goal with the mayor of bringing 5 new industries into Pageville within 3 years. The tax holiday for new industries would then represent not a concession by the mayor to you, but an action in pursuit of your shared goal. Third, stressing your shared interests can make the negotiation smoother and more amicable. Passengers in a lifeboat afloat in the middle of the ocean with limited rations will subordinate their differences over food in pursuit of their shared interest in getting to shore. Dovetail differing interests. Consider once again the 2 children quarreling over an orange. Each child wanted the orange, so they split it, failing to realize that one wanted only the fruit to eat and the other only the peel for baking. In this case, as in many others, a satisfactory agreement is made possible because each side wants different things. This is genuinely startling if you think about it. People generally assume that differences between 2 parties create the problem, yet differences can also lead to a solution. Agreement is often based on disagreement. It is as absurd to think, for example, that you should always begin by reaching agreement on the facts as it is for a buyer of stock to try to convince the seller that the stock is likely to go up. If they did agree that the stock would go up, the seller would probably not sell. What makes a deal likely is that the buyer believes the price will go up and the seller believes it will go down. The difference in belief provides the basis for a deal. Many creative agreements reflect this principle of reaching agreement through differences. Differences in interests and belief make it possible for an item to be of high benefit to you, yet low cost to the other side. Consider the nursery rhyme, "Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean, and so, betwixt them both, they licked the platter clean." The kinds of differences that best lend themselves to dovetailing are differences in interests, in beliefs, in the value placed on time, in forecasts, and in aversion to risk. Any difference in interests? This brief checklist suggests common variations in interests to look for. One party cares more about form, the other party cares more about substance. One party cares about economic considerations, the other party cares more about political considerations. One party cares about internal considerations, the other party cares about external considerations. One party cares about symbolic considerations, the other party cares about practical considerations. One party cares about immediate future, the other party cares about more distant future. One party cares more about ad hoc results, the other party cares more about the relationship. One party cares more about hardware, the other party cares more about ideology. One party cares more about progress, the other party cares more about respect for tradition. One party cares more about precedent, the other party cares more about this case. One party cares more about prestige, reputation. The other party cares more about results. One party cares more about political points. The other party cares more about group welfare. Different beliefs? If I believe I'm right and you believe you're right, we can take advantage of this difference in beliefs. We may both agree to have an impartial arbitrator settle the issue, each confident of victory. If 2 factions of the union leadership cannot agree on a certain wage proposal, they can agree to submit the issue to a membership vote. different values placed on time? You may care more about the present while the other side cares more about the future. In the language of business, you discount the future value at different rates. An installment plan works on this principle. The buyer is willing to pay a higher price for a car if it is possible to pay over time. The seller is willing to accept payment later for a higher price. Different forecasts? In a salary negotiation between an aging football star and a major team, the player may expect to win a lot of games while the team owner has the opposite expectation. Taking advantage of these different expectations, they might both agree on a modest base salary plus a big bonus if the team makes the playoffs. Differences in aversion to risk? One last kind of difference that you may capitalize on is aversion to risk. Take, for example, the issue of deep seabed mining that arose in international law of the sea negotiations. How much should mining companies pay the international community for the privilege of mining minerals from the seabed in international waters? The mining companies care more about avoiding big losses than they do about making big gains. For them, deep seabed mining is a major investment. They want to reduce the risk. The international community, on the other hand, is concerned with revenue. If some company is going to make a lot of money out of the common heritage of mankind, the rest of the world wants a generous share. In this difference lies the potential for a bargain advantageous to both sides. Risk can be traded for revenue. Exploiting this difference in aversion to risk, the resulting treaty provides for charging the companies low rates until they recover their investment. In other words, while their risk is high, and much higher rates thereafter when their risk is low. Ask for their preferences. One way to dovetail interests is to invent several options all equally acceptable to you and ask the other side which one they prefer. You want to know what is preferable, not necessarily what is acceptable. You can then take that option, work with it some more, and again present two or more variants, asking which one they prefer. In this way, without anyone's making a decision, you can improve a plan until you can find no more joint gains. For example, the agent for the sports star might ask the team owner, "What meets your interest better, a salary of $8.75 million a year for 4 years or $10 million a year for 3 years?" The latter? Okay, how about between that and $7.5 million a year for 3 years, with a $10 million bonus in each year that Fernando is voted MVP or the team wins the championship? If dovetailing had to be summed up in one sentence, it would be, look for items that are of low cost to you and high benefit to them, and vice versa. Differences in interests, priorities, beliefs, forecasts, and attitudes toward risk all make dovetailing possible. A negotiator's motto could be, Viva la différence! Make their decision easy. Since success for you in a negotiation depends upon the other side's making a decision you want, you should do what you can to make that decision an easy one. Rather than make things difficult for the other side, you want to confront them with a choice that is as painless as possible. Impressed with the merits of their own case, people usually pay too little attention to ways of advancing their case by taking care of interests on the other side. To overcome the short-sightedness that results from looking too narrowly at one's immediate self-interest, you will want to put yourself in their shoes. Without some option that appeals to them, there is likely to be no agreement at all. Whose shoes? Are you trying to influence a single negotiator, an absent boss, or some committee or other collective decision-making body? You cannot negotiate successfully with an abstraction like Houston or the University of California. Instead of trying to persuade the insurance company to make a decision, it is wiser to focus your efforts on getting one claims agent to make a recommendation. However complex the other side's decisional process may seem, you will understand it better if you pick one person, probably the person with whom you are dealing, and see how the problem looks from his or her point of view. By focusing on one person, you are not ignoring complexities. Rather, you are handling them by understanding how they impinge on the person with whom you are negotiating. You may come to appreciate your negotiating role in a new light and see your job, for example, as strengthening that person's hand or giving her arguments that she will need to persuade others to go along. One British ambassador described his job as helping my opposite number get new instructions. If you place yourself firmly in the shoes of your opposite number,
You will understand his problem and what kind of options might solve it.
What decision?
In Chapter 2, we discussed how one can understand the other side's interests by analyzing their currently perceived choice. Now you are trying to generate options that will so change their choice that they might then decide in a way satisfactory to you. Your task is to give them not a problem, but an answer. To give them not a tough decision, but an easy one. It is crucial in that process to focus your attention on the content of the decision itself. That decision is often impeded by uncertainty. Frequently, you want as much as you can get, but you yourself do not know how much that is. You are likely to say, in effect, come up with something and I will tell you if it is enough. That may seem reasonable to you, but when you look at it from the other's point of view, you will understand the need to invent a more appealing request. For whatever they do or say, you are likely to consider that merely a floor and ask for more. Requesting the other side to be more forthcoming will probably not produce a decision you want. Many negotiators are uncertain whether they are asking for words or for performance. Yet the distinction is critical. If it is performance you want, do not add something for negotiating room. If you want a horse to jump a fence, don't raise the fence. If you want to sell a soft drink from a vending machine for $2, don't mark the price at $2.50 to give yourself room to negotiate. Most of the time, you will want a promise, an agreement. Take a pencil and paper in hand and try drafting a few possible agreements. It is never too early in a negotiation to start drafting as an aid to clear thinking. Prepare multiple versions, starting with the simplest possible. What are some terms that the other party could sign, terms that would be attractive to them as well as to you? Can you reduce the number of people whose approval would be required? Can you formulate an agreement that will be easy for them to implement? The other side will take into account difficulties in carrying out an agreement. You should too. It is usually easier, for example, to refrain from doing something not being done than to stop action already underway. And it is easier to cease doing something than to undertake an entirely new course of action. If workers want music on the job, it will be easier for the company to agree not to interfere for a few weeks with an experimental employee-run program than for the company to agree to run such a program. Because most people are strongly influenced by their notions of legitimacy, one effective way to develop solutions easy for the other side to accept is to shape them so that they will appear legitimate. The other side is more likely to accept a solution if it seems the right thing to do, right in terms of being fair, legal, honorable, and so forth. Few things facilitate a decision as much as a precedent. Search for it. Look for a decision or statement that the other side may have made in a similar situation and try to base a proposed agreement on it. This provides an objective standard for your request and makes it easier for them to go along. Recognizing their probable desire to be consistent, thinking about what they have already done or said, will help you generate options acceptable to you that also take their point of view into account. Making threats is not enough. In addition to the content of the decision you would like them to make, you will want to consider from their point of view the consequences of following that decision. If you were they, what results would you most fear? What would you hope for? We often try to influence others by threats and warnings of what will happen if they do not decide as we would like. Offers are usually more effective. Concentrate both on making them aware of the consequences they can expect if they do decide as you wish and on improving those consequences from their point of view. How can you make your offers more credible? What are some specific things that they might like? Would they like to be given credit for having made the final proposal? Would they like to make the announcement? What can you invent that might be attractive to them but low in cost to yourself? To evaluate an option from the other side's point of view, consider how they might be criticized if they adopted it. Write out a sentence or two illustrating what the other side's most powerful critic might say about the decision you are thinking of asking for. Then write out a couple of sentences with which the other side might reply in defense. Such an exercise will help you appreciate the restraints within which the other side is negotiating. It should help you generate options that will adequately meet their interests so that they can make a decision that meets yours. A final test of an option is to write it out in the form of a yesable proposition. try to draft a proposal to which their responding with the single word yes would be sufficient, realistic, and operational. When you can do so, you will have reduced the risk that your immediate self-interest has blinded you to the necessity of meeting concerns of the other side. In a complex situation, creative inventing is an absolute necessity. In any negotiation, it may open doors and produce a range of potential agreements satisfactory to each side. Therefore, generate many options before selecting among them. Invent first, decide later. Look for shared interests and differing interests to dovetail, and seek to make their decision easy. Chapter 5. Insist on using objective criteria. However well you understand the interests of the other side, however ingeniously you invent ways of reconciling interests, however highly you value an ongoing relationship, you will almost always face the harsh reality of interests that conflict. No talk of win-win strategies can conceal that fact. You want the rent to be lower, the landlord wants it to be higher. You want the goods delivered tomorrow, the supplier would rather deliver them next week. You definitely prefer the large office with the view, so does your partner. Such differences cannot be swept under the rug. Deciding on the basis of will is costly. Typically, negotiators try to resolve such conflicts by positional bargaining. In other words, by talking about what they are willing and unwilling to accept. One negotiator may demand substantive concessions simply because he insists upon them. The price is $5,000 and that's that. Another may make a generous offer, hoping to gain approval or friendship. Whether the situation becomes a contest over who can be the most stubborn or a contest over who can be the most generous, this negotiating process focuses on what each side is willing to agree to. The outcome results from the interaction of two human wills, almost as if the negotiators were living on a desert island with no history, no customs, and no moral standards. As discussed in Chapter 1, trying to reconcile differences on the basis of will has serious costs. No negotiation is likely to be efficient or amicable if you pit your will against theirs, and either you have to back down or they do. And whether you are choosing a place to eat, organizing a business, or negotiating custody of a child, you are unlikely to reach a wise agreement as judged by any objective standard if you take no such standard into account. If trying to settle differences of interest on the basis of will has such high costs, the solution is to negotiate on some basis independent of the will of either side, that is, on the basis of objective criteria. The case for using objective criteria. Suppose you have entered into a fixed-price construction contract for your house that calls for reinforced concrete foundations but fails to specify how deep they should be. The contractor suggests 2 feet. You think 5 feet is closer to the usual depth for your type of house. Now, suppose the contractor says, "I went along with you on steel girders for the roof. It's your turn to go along with me on shallower foundations." No owner in his right mind would yield. Rather than horse trade, you would insist on deciding the issue in terms of objective safety standards. "Look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe 2 feet is enough. What I want are foundations strong and deep enough to hold up the building safely. Does the government have standard specifications for these soil conditions? How deep are the foundations of other buildings in this area? What is the earthquake risk here? Where do you suggest we look for standards to resolve this question?" It is no easier to build a good contract than it is to build strong foundations. If relying on objective standards applies so clearly to a negotiation between the house owner and a contractor, why not to business deals, collective bargaining, legal settlements, and international negotiations? Why not insist that a negotiated price, for example, be based on some standards such as market value, replacement cost, depreciated book value, or competitive prices, instead of whatever the seller demands? In short, the approach is to commit yourself to reaching a solution based on principle, not pressure. Concentrate on the merits of the problem, not the mettle of the parties. Be open to reason, but closed to threats. Principled negotiation produces wise agreements amicably and efficiently. The more you bring standards of fairness, efficiency, or scientific merit to bear on your particular problem, the more likely you are to produce a final package that is wise and fair. The more you and the other side refer to precedent and community practice, the greater your chance of benefiting from past experience. And an agreement consistent with precedent is less vulnerable to attack. If a lease contains standard terms, or if a sales contract conforms to practice in the industry, there is less risk that either negotiator will feel that he was harshly treated or will later try to repudiate the agreement. A constant battle for dominance threatens a relationship. Principled negotiation protects it. It is far easier to deal with people when both of you are discussing objective standards for settling a problem instead of trying to force each other to back down. Approaching agreement through discussion of objective criteria also reduces the number of commitments that each side must make and then unmake as they move toward agreement. In positional bargaining, negotiators spend much of the time defending their position and attacking the other sides. People using objective criteria tend to use time more efficiently talking about possible standards and solutions. Independent standards are even more important to efficiency when more parties are involved. In such cases, positional bargaining is difficult at best. It requires coalitions among parties, and the more parties who have agreed on a position, the more difficult it becomes to change that position. Similarly, if each negotiator has a constituency or has to clear a position with a higher authority, the task of adopting positions and then changing them becomes time-consuming and difficult. An episode during the Law of the Sea negotiations illustrates the merits of using objective criteria. At one point, India, representing the Third World Bloc, proposed an initial fee for companies mining in the deep seabed of $60 million per site. The United States rejected the proposal, suggesting there be no initial fee. Both sides dug in. The matter became a contest of will. Then someone discovered that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, had developed a model for the economics of deep seabed mining. This model, gradually accepted by the parties as objective, provided a way of evaluating the impact of any fee proposal on the economics of mining. When the Indian representative asked about the effect of his proposal, he was shown how the tremendous fee he proposed, payable 5 years before the mine would generate any revenue, would make it virtually impossible for a company to mine. Impressed, he announced that he would reconsider his position. On the other side, the MIT model helped educate the American representatives, whose information on the subject had been mostly limited to that provided by the mining companies. The model indicated that some initial fee was economically feasible. As a result, the United States also changed its position. No one backed down, no one appeared weak, just reasonable. After a lengthy negotiation, the parties reached a tentative agreement that was mutually satisfactory. The MIT model increased the chance of agreement and decreased costly posturing. It led to a better solution, one that would both attract companies to do mining and generate considerable revenue for the nations of the world. The existence of an objective model able to forecast the consequences of any proposal helped convince the parties that the tentative agreement they reached was fair. This in turn strengthened relationships among the negotiators and made it more likely an agreement would endure. Developing objective criteria. Carrying on a principled negotiation involves two questions. How do you develop objective criteria? And how do you use them in negotiating? Whatever method of negotiation you use, you will do better if you prepare in advance. This certainly holds true of principled negotiation. So develop some alternative standards beforehand and think through their application to your case. Fair standards. You will usually find more than one objective criterion available as a basis for agreement. Suppose, for example, your car is demolished and you file a claim with an insurance company. In your discussion with the adjuster, you might take into account such measures of the car's value as, 1, the original cost of the car less depreciation, 2, what the car could have been sold for, 3, the standard blue book value for a car of that year and model, 4, what it would cost to replace that car with a comparable one, and 5, what a court might award as the value of the car. In other cases, depending on the issue, you may wish to propose that an agreement be based upon market value, precedent, scientific judgment, professional standards, efficiency,
costs, what a court would decide, moral standards, equal treatment, tradition, reciprocity, etc. At a minimum, objective criteria need to be independent of each side's will. Ideally, to assure a wise agreement,